This week, gold and silver staged impressive rebound rallies, finishing near the highs while stocks recoiled from yet new all-time record highs. Welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. The show begins its ninth consecutive year this month. A special thanks to all of our listeners and subscribers for staying with us all these years. On this January 3rd program, the first show of the new year, Peter Granditz joins me with his outlook on the markets. He says as a gold bull, he continues to lick his wounds, but after a tough year, he expects the worm to turn in 2014. My next featured guest makes his debut appearance on the show. David Gerwitz is a Renaissance man with a penchant for not only gold, but algo trading. He thinks the precious metals are gearing up for a big move. Then Robert Ian returns with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek Radio begins now with a Market Weatherman report. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week. Gold futures blasted higher due in part to expectations of soaring global demand for the physical metal. The Reserve Bank of India agreed to remove some gold import restrictions, further increasing demand. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold added $24, finishing the week near $12.37 an ounce. Silver picked up about 10 cents, finishing at $20.17 an ounce. Platinum outperformed, adding $40, up about 3%, ending the week near $14.14, and palladium gained about $20, closing near $7.31 an ounce. Finally, copper finished a six-week rally off slightly, ending near $3.36. Turning to the global economy, data from China this week indicated that factory output declined to a four-month low last month. The non-manufacturing purchasing managers index fell to 54.6. That was the worst showing in about 6 months and below analysts' expectations. Gold fell to a six-month low, but bargain hunters saw opportunity in the discounted prices in China amid the Lunar New Year holiday festivities expected this month. China will earn the sobriquet of the biggest gold importer of the year, due in part to the nouveau riche middle class and gold-hungry People's Bank of China. The premium paid for gold delivery in China, the world's biggest consumer and producer, is ranging between $20 and $30 an ounce. China's consumption of jewelry, bars, and coins rose 30% to 1,000 metric tons last year, while usage in India, the second biggest buyer, was just behind China, according to the World Gold Council. Down below in the Southern Hemisphere, the Perth Mint cited increasing demand for gold coins and bars last year, according to a Goldcorp report. Bloomberg.com corroborated the story, noting that the Perth Mint of Western Australia saw a very significant increase in sales in 2013, despite the falling prices. The Perth Mint refines most of the bullion produced from the world's second biggest producing nation, Australia, which increased 41% last year. Silver coin sales increased by 33% to about 9 million ounces, while gold sales improved by 12%. The U.S. Mint also saw a 14% expansion in American gold coin eagles last year. Sales climbed 17% to 56,000 ounces in December alone, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. In an interview this week, gold pundit Jim Rickards noted that the precious metals fell last year due partially to technical reasons as well as market manipulation, but that physical gold is evaporating from Western inventories and appearing in China's stockpiles. The market watcher made the bold prediction that gold will soar to over $7,000 an ounce, at which point little, if any, will be available to the masses. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, despite a solid dollar rally this week, the precious metals staged an impressive rally of their own. So you'll want to be sure to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter on Monday for next week's forecast. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, after briefly hitting an all-time record high, cloudy skies returned to the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow Jones Industrials finished the week off only 8 points, finishing at 16,469 by Friday's close. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points, ending at 1831, off about 0.5%, while the Nasdaq actually shed 25 points, about 0.5% for the week, just above 4131. In a prepared speech in Philadelphia, the Federal Reserve Chairman Dr. Bernanke said that the economic recovery is continuing, noting that a combination of financial healing, greater balance in the housing market, and less fiscal restraints was helping the domestic economy. 2013 registered the best annual gain in 16 years amid strong fourth quarter corporate growth and consumer confidence for the stock market. The S&P ended at a new annual high for the first time since the dot-com bubble days of 1999. Fed officials said last month they will reduce their monthly purchases of assets down from $85 billion a month to $75 billion starting this month, citing faster-than-estimated economic growth. Still, the small downshift was viewed as a token effort, suggesting more of the same QE in 2014. Turning to stocks making the news, FireEye Inc., ticker FEYE, soared 36% on news of its purchase of Mandiant Corp, a $1 billion deal involving services that guard networks against hackers. Plus, Delta Airlines rose 5.5%, the biggest gain on the S&P 500 following news of improved revenues. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, according to the 7-component sentiment index that we follow, greed is returning to the markets, but it just hasn't quite reached those overextended levels. The January effect could come into play here, and that's where investors who sold for tax losses last month tend to buy back in January, making it a particularly solid time to buy, especially for smaller caps. However, you know, with the indexes higher across the board, I think the impact of this effect could be mooted. More GoldSeek.com radio with Peter Grandich and David Gerwitz, so we want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. Well, with 2013 officially in the rearview mirror, investors want to know what to expect in the new year. Peter Grandich joins me for a brief overview of last year's trading and offers his insights. Peter Grandich has published commentary on the mining sector and metals markets for decades, and is now the senior market commentator for Money Talks. Happy New Year, Peter Grandich.
Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
You know, I'd like to start off the discussion, if we could, please, with a brief recapitulation of 2013. The year of the equities rally, the Dow Jones Industrials and the S&P 500 hit record highs. Even the NASDAQ is approaching the dot-com bubble figures from almost 15 years ago. Much of this was due to the trillion-dollar annual money injection, if you will, or buying spree at the Fed. You care to outline your view of 2013 before we move on to the new year, please?
Sure. I had, while not an outright bull by any means, I had actually covered my very bearish position in March of 2009, and at that time said we would have what I believed at the time would be the greatest bear market rally we ever saw. We had it and then some. I did not want to go short or bet against the market because I thought the market, based on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was tracing out a multi-decade technical bearish pattern known as a megaphone. And I wrote about it extensively throughout last year, and it was just literally 2 days before the end of the year when I felt that we had done enough securing that pattern and all the fundamental reasons that I put in my report that I put on my growling bear hat again. But nevertheless, it was a big year to the upside. I do agree with you fully. A lot of it had to do with the money that was supplied by the Fed and not general economic fundamentals. But I think the time has come where the stock market resorts back to what it was originally set up to be, and that is a place where people buy part ownerships of businesses. And businesses basically live or die based on the economy. And I just think there's a whole host of reasons to think that the economy will not do very well, and therefore stocks are pretty well priced at high levels. And if the risk now is more to the downside than the reward to the upside.
I think we have to also bear in mind that many of these corporations have benefited by, you might say, cutting excesses, by downsizing. That works in the near term, but you lose a lot of intellectual capital and people rein in their spending. Short term, wise, longer term, not so much. This is a market of stocks, and it's going to be, I think, even more important to find those hidden gems in order to be successful. Any other comments?
Yeah, I actually do work quite extensively with small to mid-sized businesses and my two other businesses I have. And although we're based in New Jersey, our clients are all around the country. And the thing I hear just all the time, and as seemingly each week and month goes by, I hear it more and more and louder from many of the clients that we have, and that is it's harder than ever for business people to do business. And that's the simplest way to put it, that through a whole series of regulations and all sorts of economic issues, social and political, it's just harder and harder to do. And, you know, I think the other thing that is very important that got lost in this, and this is the only reason I don't think Obama has been really slammed, because overall there's really nothing to point to. He really made his bet on his name on this Obamacare, and it's a big bust. But because the stock market has risen, a lot of people have not really taken into account or seen firsthand that we've really not had any real fiscal good management out of Washington, D.C., going past his administration back several administrations. There has not been good fiscal policy coming out of Washington. I hear that through all the business groups I'm involved with, chamber leaders, what have you. And the only thing that's masked that is the stock market has risen. But if you talk to individual business people, they think it's really a house of cards because they say it's so difficult to operate. So I think all these things are kind of come home to roost. That's why, you know, just a couple of days ago, I decided to put on the growling bear hat again and really want to shy away from really any U.S. equities that are not related to natural resources.
You know, I think you make a great point with regard to difficulties, particularly for the small and medium-sized business owner in this country. And Dr. Ron Paul penned a very interesting article with regard to minimum wage. You know, I did work for minimum wage, and even after school, had minimum wage jobs. So I'm certainly not casting any aspersions here, because he points out that essentially this ideology of raising the minimum wage to a minimum of $10 per hour looks great on paper. You know, I mean, you feel good. You're helping the downtrodden, hopefully pulling some folks away from the poverty line. But he, I think, aptly points out that this tends to backfire, because sure, a few people benefit by earning that $10 an hour, but then the small businesses either go out of business or are forced to cut back on their staff because they simply just can't afford the increase. And again, it's the proletariat who suffer.
Well, having some clients that have fast food businesses, particularly some names that people would know, they will tell you, and if you know their business, the lion's share is their labor costs. It's not as profitable as everybody thinks when you open a household name place and you make millions. The names we're used to, the major corporations make more normally than the franchisee, depending on how the deals are struck. But nevertheless, labor costs are a tremendous single factor in those operations. When you talk about changing it a very large amount from whatever it was in a very short period of time, it does impact them a lot. So I agree with what you just said and what Ron Paul said. I do think we have to keep in mind that, you know, we want to look for a fair wage. And I think markets tend to, you know, decide what that is. You know, I just like to make this point because we just had the bowl game by Chick-fil-A. I mean, Chick-fil-A, I think, is the poster child for how those type of operations should run and how well even people down on the lower level are treated and given opportunity. And they get that because, in turn, they help performance at those places. They get a lot of opportunity in education and other areas and health benefits that others don't get. A very fair man that obviously runs Chick-fil-A. And so that is the poster child that you can pay a fair wage and pay good benefits, and people benefit from it, but they kind of make sure that the right people benefited from it, that it's not just wasted in dollars that then don't go to meaningful situations where in their situations the people are getting education they might have not otherwise gotten, can move out of that level and step up to much higher skilled positions. I think that's another factor, but I don't want to lose sight, and again, it's not often discussed in the don't worry, be happy talking heads, but we have not had really any favorable business legislation on any scale for any length of time for years now, and that has really hindered business. And that's why when the talking heads talk about, well, all these companies have a lot of cash. Well, one of the reasons is because they're really afraid to implement and use that cash because they don't have any certainty of where their business is going to be tomorrow based on regulation and other things the government impacts it on.
Incidentally, my uncle, one of his closest and dearest friends, is Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A. Clearly, the lust for stock profits and rising interest rates rattled the precious metals markets last year. James Turk announced this week that he sees higher rates ahead. Do you see this rate threat continuing this year, or will the Fed slam the brakes on rates?
When the 10-year was under 2%, actually close to 1.75%, I wrote a report that called U.S. bonds the worst investment for the next 10 years. One of the typical kind of responses I had back from people, constructive criticism or outright just disbelief, was centered on the fact that with the Fed continuing to ease and the economy not strong, how could bonds not do anything but stay a, you know, a viable investment? And I try to explain to them, some to what they would, you know, they seem deaf, nodding to want to understand the artificial nature of how rates were driven to where they were, that it wasn't a market that drove it there, but it was the Fed's action. But then I always ask both them and I always ask any financial journalist willing to listen to just get one answer for me. And when they get that answer for me, then I would change my opinion. And that question that I propose to them is simply this. If the Fed is going to taper, and that's what, you know, was talked about and what kept the pressing in part gold throughout 2012, they would taper, interest rates go high, that would be bad for gold, yada, yada, yada. If they were up to 80% at times of all the new purchases of bonds, and the country's still running at a deficit, a significant one, so we have to keep floating these bonds just to live day to day, let alone worry about what we have to pay back, what we already owe, who's going to replace the Fed? No one, in all honesty, seems to ever want to bring that up. And so the question I have when the tapering comes, and whether we argue whether the tapering won't last, and I don't think it will. I think they'll get to the point where the economy will really slip again. The Fed has put on this hat as the cure-all for everything in the fiscal and otherwise in the U.S., and they'll be forced to create another quantitative easing program. But whatever tapering they do, please someone tell me, unless we have a higher interest rate that attracts new buyers, who's going to step up? So I, no matter how weak the economy was or what the Fed was going to do, it just seemed that bonds were very, very overvalued. And I think we've seen that already. And what people didn't want to understand, and this was very interesting, and I addressed this to people more than own bond funds than individual bonds. It's a big difference. Well, when your bond fund, whatever was being priced at when the 10-year was around 1.75% and now it's around 3%, you're looking already at a double-digit principal loss. And unlike a bond, which if you just hold to maturity, you'll at least get that principal back. Who knows what's going to happen in these bond funds? So if rates just go to 4 or 5 and those bond funds were loaded up with 2s and 3s, at the end of the day, you're going to have substantial losses. And you're not supposed to have losses. That's why you were in the bonds to begin with. So I still believe bonds are a very dangerous investment. Yes, they're up in yield, but I still think there's quite a ways to go. And I think if they even came close to going back to national averages that we've seen for years, there can still be substantial double-digit losses for something that's supposed to provide safety of principal and income.
Yeah, it's going to be such an interesting tug of war, I think, going forward here. You know, on the one hand, we remember watching Japan with zero interest rates for virtually just seemingly forever. But at some point, rates do have to go back to their natural level. You know, I would be a wary bondholder. Want to move on to comments from billionaire Hugo Salinas Price, the Mexican silver pundit there, you might say. He's been a big supporter of the precious metals, and he noted this week that the Mexican mint has run out of silver for minting coins. And, you know, this wouldn't be a big surprise, I think, if it was the U.S. or maybe somewhere in Europe. But Mexico, as I understand it, is one of the, if not the largest, silver producers worldwide. Any thoughts?
Well, it goes back to something that perhaps is the most frustrating part of the last 12 to almost 24 months as someone who's had his head handed to him in the gold and silver market, both in the bullion and especially in the mining share, particularly as we went down further the food chain. And that has been the extreme frustration to know and see it firsthand and hear it firsthand, that there's really a two-tier gold and silver market. There's the paper market that most people hear about and listen to, and then there's the real market, what I like to call the physical market at the end of the day. And we've had this discussion over and over, and there's no need to go into it in great detail other than to say that we just continue to see just dramatic physical buy-in of gold and silver in all areas of the world outside the United States. Even in the United States for itself, not like in China and all, we've seen a notable pickup. And that just goes to argue, how can that be? And I think there's been decent explanations in recent weeks. I placed one up on our blog, I think last night, that someone had made to explain really the great transfer of gold from the West to the East has been underway. And once that transfer is near completing, and we suspect that it's close to it, we are going to see a dramatic rally back in the gold prices, both in the paper and the physical. And so as hard as it's been to accept what's happened, and as frustration as it is to listen to this nonsense, I mean, can you imagine what bothered me the most in these last waning days of the old year was all the articles that came out just rehashing of how poor gold did it this past year. And what would always be in all the articles was, after 12 straight years, gold wasn't, and it went into hammered or whatever it was. Can you imagine if the stock market went up for 12 years in a row, and on the 13th year it lost 30%? I would bet everything I still have left that the typical comment coming out from Wall Street and all the journalists that follow them was, hey, it's a great buying opportunity. Look, it went up for 12 straight years. What's 30% off? You should be in there right now buying with both fists. But because it's gold and it's the most hated investment among the financial world, here's something that does so well for 12 years. It's 13th year. It's finally down, and it's a piece of garbage. Get rid of it. It's never going to have to see the light of day again. And just when you combine that with the simple fact of what we know is happening in the physical market, you just have to have the confidence and know that that day is going to turn, and when it turns, and it might have started now, but if it didn't and we have one last assault or whatever it may be, we are going to see, we're not going to have to live too much longer to see those old highs made a couple of years taken out, because when it turns, it's going to be extremely fast and vicious to the upside. And if you thought it was painful for us bulls on the downside, I think the bears are going to be in a bull market rally that they never could have imagined if happened. And so I take some confidence in the fact that, like you said, that this physical market continues to be, because remember this, basically, these physical buyers are putting this away. This is not something for trading. And there's only so much produced. And, you know, one of the positives of the negatives of the mining share end has been there's really been no money going in to new exploration and development, and mines are shutting down and so forth. And it's like a battleship. You just don't turn that on a dime and the floodgate opens again. So I think we're setting up for an extremely bullish supply and demand scenario for both gold and silver going forward.
You know, in retrospect, during the housing smash, or the initial stages there, commentator after commentator would announce, oh, we're only down 3%. What a bargain. 5%. What a bargain. 10%. What an incredible buying opportunity is all we heard in the housing market. That is until we drop 20, 25%. But we're not talking about a 10-year unbroken housing market there. We had a 75-year in housing. And here, after just a few years of capitulation, it's just back to the races as usual, as though nothing ever was wrong. Nothing ever happened. Any other comments? Anything else on your radar screen you'd like to share with the listeners, please?
I just think it ties into something you just finished on, and I think can close on that. Perhaps some of the biggest voices for the stock market at the moment and totally against the precious metals market are some of the household investment banker names that we know. And I try to remind people a few days ago when I wrote in a commentary that it was just 5 years ago when many of those same household names were selling an absorbent amount of bad product And this is all came out in congressional investigations and papers that were written. This is not speculation. This is fact according to actual investigations and disclosures and settlements and things of that nature, that these guys were selling, guys and gals, were selling a whole host of bad products, knew full well that they would not work for their clients, and were taking the other side of that bet. And the way I try to, for people to understand it, to put it in the simplest terms, imagine if you turned on the news tonight and you heard that GM, Chrysler, and Ford over the last few years built cars knowing they were going to crash, and they bought life insurance on the buyers of those cars so they can collect when they did crash. We would just be up in arms. And as the report that came out a few days ago about a judge that got so upset about this, who pointed out that after all this, no one of any consequences has gone to jail or been found guilty of this. Now, those very same people who we were told we had to bail them out because the whole world was going to come to an end, which we did, are making hands over foot, and they're telling you you need to be long in stocks and bonds, and you need to be absolutely out of things like gold and silver. Well, you know what? If not for any reason but that, I think I'll bet against them again.
To me, it was an extinction-level event. It was averted simply by the injection of untold tens of trillions of dollars into the system. They kept that game of musical chairs going, but at some point, it's going to stop. And my guess is we won't have the luxury of much preparation, of many warning signs when it finally does. Maybe those of us who were in the trenches during 2007 through 2009 are still reeling from the impact, but I certainly would be trying to get my house in order if I was the typical investor these days.
I think this year is a reckoning year. I do think one other topic we haven't touched on real quickly that's important. I think we'll start to see the dollar take even more gas. And I think if we go back and reread what all these guys predicted over the last years of where the dollar was supposed to go to, and it really hasn't budged, and it's really at the low end of its trading range based on the U.S. dollar index. I think when you throw that into the mix and we start to see that come down as well and really break 80 and get into the mid-70s on the dollar index, I think that's going to coincide with a very declining stock and bond market and a certainly strong rebound in the gold and silver market.
You know, the greenback has been hovering now for 3 years. It should have at least staged some type of recovery rally. I'm frankly surprised that we haven't heard more of this from the talking heads. I mean, it's had every single opportunity, and yet it just every time it tries to break out, it knocks further and further back down into this broad trading range. And to me, a truly negative, an bearish sign for the dollar, which probably does bode well for commodities and precious metals. Peter Grandich, we want to thank you today and wish you continued success in the new year, sir.
Thank you.
Well, David Gurwitz is my special guest today, Managing Director at Charles Nenner Research. How are you, sir?
Great. How you doing? How's the weather down there?
Gorgeous weather after days of rain. I hope it's not too bad in that neck of the woods there.
It's pretty bad. It's in New York. We got a snowstorm.
Let's start off, if we could, with the precious metal sector. You know, it's been a tough year after 12 wonderful years. And, of course, that's brought the bears out of their caves. So why don't you give people an overview of what you see developing?
Well, first thing, we 2 years ago called the top in 1900. So that we kind of feel good about after it was, I think, a 10-year run-up or maybe 12. I think it was 10 years.
Yeah, it really depends on what you call the beginning of the bull market.
Right. So that was a great call. And a lot of people didn't want to get out because after 10 years up, they figured it's just a correction. You get used to it. And we said, no, it's not going to be a 2% down. I think we should get out and wait to the bottom, which is kind of how we try and do things for all the categories, ideally stocks, bonds, commodities, currencies. Try and get out of tops and get into bottoms. Like, you know, Bernard Baruch said, but he doesn't like to sell at the top or buy at the bottom. We like to be close. Anyway, we got out of gold, and we said there'd be a few bounces, which there were. And today we actually went long. Funny, of today we said we'll give gold a try to buy it on a close above 1293 and silver on a close above 2160. It's a short-term move. We still think there's one more down move, and it could take it under 1,200 gold and down in the 16s for silver, but we think we will go back up to the highs. It's going to take a while till it really starts. It's a short-term trade now.
We've seen the U.S. dollar struggling despite the sharp sell-off and meandering in gold and silver. And one would think, at least from a fundamental and technical basis, that that's an indication of overdone in the selling category on precious metals. You would have expected to see the greenback soar as gold and silver were suffering, and we just haven't seen that. We've seen a three-year consolidation. I just would have expected to see the dollar climb sharply. Of course, there's many other factors there, and we have euro factors, and the currency markets are a bit more complex. But in general, we had seen that, you know, inverse relationship hold true between precious metals and the dollar. Any comments on the greenback?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all your listeners should write to the site, charlesnenner.com, and mention that we listen to us talking, and they get a free month of the subscription of the research, which covers stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies three times a week, and charts we send out on Sunday. But let me discuss the currencies we cover, because you're asking a dollar question. We cover the dollar all week in the form of its relationship to other currencies, the euro, the Aussie, the Canadian, and the yen. We even cover the euro-yen, and we cover the shekel. So those are six currencies covered. Most Americans don't focus on trading currencies, which they should. It's still the biggest market in the world. And that's how, when the market starts Sunday night at 6 o'clock, pretty much things will turn from currency to bond to stock all electronically in an hour. So anyway, the euro is strong. And we predicted that it would be, and we still think it's going to be. That's why the euro-yen, we think the yen is down, the euro's up, therefore the euro-yen cross is going to be a very strong move. The dollar, we think, is, even though it's been weaker, it's going to rally, and then it's going to hit its top in the first or second quarter and then be down for quite a while, which is, again, your very thoughtful comments about the gold-dollar connection before. They don't always hold true just because we think A always implies B. It doesn't work like that. We think cycles are what always works. And therefore, the gold cycle doesn't tie in with the dollar cycle always, but at times it will look like it does, and so you can't really extrapolate from that. But we think the dollar, the euro will be stronger. The Aussie longer term will be stronger. We called the Aussie and the Canadian to par 4 years ago when they were 68 to the dollar. So people need to take a longer-term perspective on the currencies, and they can play them with ETFs. They're fairly easy to do. But that's what we think is going to happen with the dollar, and that's the gold-silver connection. Silver is going to move faster than gold now, in our opinion.
It also corrected much more heavily on the downside after moving threefold from 2010 into 2011. So you would expect a sharper recovery rally there. I also wanted to ask you about your economic views, particularly with regard to that upbeat unemployment U3 number we saw last week from the Labor Department. The unemployment rate apparently dropping to 7%. Some controversy around this number coming from folks in the gold crowd arguing that essentially this number is a bit bogus, that we're actually seeing a huge number of dislocated workers, and that really just distorts the figure and makes it look more robust than it actually is. And of course, that would more than likely keep the Fed from curtailing and tapering their QE purchases in the future if this is a bogus number. I'd like your thoughts.
Great question. We agree with you, or what you just said, that the unemployment numbers don't really tell the story. We did predict a stronger first quarter economy a few months ago, so it happened. We think things are topping overall in the stock market into the first quarter. So we think the bond market will be stronger at the first half of next year, but longer term, the bonds are going to be, look, rates have come down for 30 years, which Charles, when he was at Goldman Sachs for 15 years, predicted. I joined working with him about 10 years ago, and the rates were 18% 30 years ago. 60 years ago, they were what they are now. That's called a cycle, a 60-year cycle. It goes the other way starting in a few quarters, that bond prices will go down, we think, because bond rates will go up for the next 2.5 decades. So when you have bonds going down, and we think longer-term stocks are going down, it's going to be very dislocating. That looks like the gold will go up then, the silver will go up then. Grains, which we haven't really talked about, we're getting close to a shorter-term low, but later on in the year, a better low in grains and grain stocks, which is something people should think about. We haven't talked about crude or natural gas. We can get that in a second. But basically, the whole idea of the economy and tying in, I mean, we're hitting lots of stories of, while the market's up for 5 years, basically, people's jobs and their smaller businesses are not doing well. And we have thousands of clients. We always ask them, how's your business? The market's up. Not good, not good, not good. So that's anecdotal. And we think same thing with the unemployment as well. It may look low, but there's a lot of people not being counted in as far as the way we look at it.
No, exactly. I mean, we're really seeing a dichotomy in the economy where you have, whereas the backbone of the country, the smaller business owner suffering. And of course, that just is unsustainable. Also wanted to address the interesting global demand component to the gold story. You know, total Chinese gold demand continues to soar. They're going to be apparently the number one gold importer as well as producer.
Great question again. We look at math and we believe, even though it's called technical, what the math represents is in fact deeply fundamental. What's fundamental is that the world moves in cycles, coming from the Greek word circle. This kind of works for everything, and then I'll address the gold thing in particular. So we think the cycles show human interpretation of events. We can't predict what the event is. When we called the top an apple, we didn't know what it was. We called it a 702. We didn't know the top in gold what it was. You know, you never know. We just see the cycles topping at something, and then the news people will come along and explain why it is or isn't. So when you look at China starting to buy and their economy starting to maybe pick up, we predicted that a year ago, that China wouldn't be so strong, and then approximately now it would be. And again, you can take advantage of it with ETFs. But China gold buying, we don't really follow in our gold price. Just, you know, we just look at gold, silver, copper, which we actually said to get out of a year and a half ago, because one of the Far East sovereign wealth funds, we have those type of clients also, $80 billion, $90 billion. Again, we don't manage money, and we don't broker. We just tell what's going to happen as best we can see. You know, gold's been down for 2 years. All of a sudden, China's becoming a buyer, and it looks like gold's bottoming temporarily. So we think the cycles are the predictor of the activity, not the other way around.
I like the concept of looking at the numbers behind the cycles and the market trends, because ultimately those prices are dictated by the fundamentals. It's really difficult, I think, in this environment. Markets have changed a lot. I'm sure you'd agree in the last 5-10 years since algorithmic trading. I don't believe you can really be merely a fundamental or a technical investor and have much success. It really requires a melange of the two. You talked earlier about the idea that we maybe haven't quite bottomed. What signs are you going to be looking for if this rally fizzles?
But number one, that's, again, great question, and I'd like your readers to write in so they could start seeing how we follow it. We see another bottom coming, which means this is an up move, but it's a temporary up move. So what signs we look for are simply cycle tops. And also we give a target level once it starts to move. We can't give one till it starts to move, because our target algorithm, as opposed to the cycles, which only give us direction, the target algorithm is based on quantum physics and some very, very complicated acceleration calculations. So we need to have it start to move first, so I can't give an upside target yet. However, once we start going there and the cycle tops, let's say, in 2 months, we could say, okay, our target of, let's go 1420, I'll just pick a number, it gets there and the cycle's topping January 30th, let's just say. Okay, target's there, cycle's there, it's like a football quarterback. Go back, 1, 2, 3, 4, throw to the spot where the end's supposed to be, and we'll tell everybody get out, and then it should turn down again, which is why we're not saying take a long-term position now. Then we think after that down move, and it hits a target which we think is going to go then, that might be the place to go longer-term long for gold and silver. So there's really three trades. There's an up trade, there's a down trade, and then there's an up trade again. Depending on the sophistication and the risk tolerance of every investor, they play it differently. And all we can do is kind of show what we see, and then every investor takes it accordingly.
Now you've really piqued my interest. You start to talk about quantum mechanics. Really like to know what type of formulae. I mean, are we talking about Brownian motion?
That's one. It's funny you should ask that. You obviously know. I went to a place called the Bronx High School of Science. Charles Netter is a medical doctor, but a pretty significant scientist as well. Our target algorithm is very complicated. It's like 40,000 lines of code. It utilizes a lot of different things that are not typical. And again, what you were saying before, that the world is fundamental and technical, we agree with you, except we think our technicals are fundamental. I know that may sound like a word use, but the reality is if something's repeating, if you're making an assumption in any data series, for cycles anyway, that if IBM topped every 5 weeks, 20 weeks, 37 weeks, 53 weeks, so you have sine curves, and all those sine curves coincide next week, and it turns out to be a top, is that technical or is that fundamental? We think it's fundamental, that that is what's guiding the world. So therefore, we're able to predict stuff based on that, that the news and other A implies B logic doesn't go. As far as target, quantum physics, if I could summarize it in a sentence, which is kind of hard to do, doesn't mean A implies B. Quantum physics means B has to happen, therefore A is going to show up to make it happen. So it really is not cause and effect. Effect comes first and the cause shows up after. Which is a very interesting idea, that two-minute conversation we can't have now. I've studied this, Charles studied, so that's inherent in our system. Very hard to explain, obviously, but that's how else do you pick targets? How do you say that IBM, how do you pick Apple top at 702 down below 500, which we called? He himself doesn't know. How did he get out of RIM at the top? How did he get out at gold at the top? It's really based on these very complicated mathematical formulas that are based on mathematical assumptions that are prevalent in all of society. For instance, the Elliott wave, which we've all heard about and somewhat know. He happens to be a real expert in it. Elliott wave is the most Fibonacci is the basis of the Elliott wave, the most prevalent pattern in nature. If you Google Fibonacci, he was a mathematician in the 1400s. He found a pattern, every number is the sum of the previous two, by far the most prevalent pattern in nature. It would make sense that it's in the markets, because the markets reflect humans, and humans reflect all that. But how do you combine it all? And look, you know, Charles sits with six screens. We have a few other people do it. I can't do that stuff. You know, that's not my strength. But I know people who do it in our company, and they're right most of the time. They're not right all the time. Nobody is. But it's based on math that recurs, so we think it's fundamental, even though people call us technical.
Raise even more questions that I have for you. I mean, for instance, I just have a passion for numbers, and I was working on something you may have heard of called the Beal conjecture. It's similar to Fermat's last theorem. I think the last check there was a $1 million prize, by the way, for our listeners who are mathematically inclined. Interestingly enough, the fellow who's offering the prize, his name is Mr. Beal, a billionaire offering $1 million to whoever cracks the Beal theorem. But the reason I mention it is that some of the cosine and sine while working on that problem seem to me, you know, this might just be applicable to the markets.
My guess, and I don't know how many listeners you have. I don't know whether we're going over their heads right now. You know, we're thinking, you
pretty
know,
sharp folks and listening in this crowd here.
Yeah, okay. You have a bunch of sharp folks, I assume. If you're the questioner, they're used to you, that you're not going in for little questions, which I love. But most people don't want to go there. But I'm a math person also. As a matter of fact, if people listening, they go to my music site, davidgurwitz.com. I'm a concert pianist composer, and I became that based on math. Because the professor in college, when I was in college at Brandeis University in 1974, drew a Fibonacci sequence under a picture of a keyboard and showed a C to C keyboard as 13 keys, 8 white, 5 black, group of 3, group of 2. That's Fibonacci. And I was a basketball player. I ran down to the music building. I had it in my hand. So I became a musician because of the music math connection. So that's why I love this. I mean, we could talk about this for 5 hours, you know. And I've studied quantum physics, and I'm familiar with the Beal issue. I was reading about it, actually. I don't have that. I'm not that smart that I could crack it. I have to tell you that much. But I deal with some very smart people that I love to learn from. And so those who are mathematical, which are not most of the world, can appreciate where we're coming from in the research, that it is based on math, and can't dismiss so quickly that it's not based on the news. We kind of predict the news, and it's based on numbers from the past. You're talking, for instance, wheat. We have prices going back 800 years. So we have cycles in effect, going back from data 800 years ago, whereas Facebook, I can't predict because we only have data trading 18 months. How long is Facebook public? A year. So we need more math to come up with patterns, and the longer back we go, interest rates, we go, believe it or not, we go back 1,000 years with interest rates.
The unsung hero, and this is someone I would direct you, if you're ever curious, and the listeners as well, Euler, and in my opinion, really was the greatest mathematician who ever lived by a factor of at least tenfold. And I don't want to digress too much. The unsung hero that not even many mathematicians revere today, his Euler constant I'm using all the time in my humble scribblings here, trying to crack the markets as well. The oil, you know, 2.71 is of incredible use. So I just want to throw that out there because I know there's going to be some sharp, you know, math majors listening to this, and it might inspire them to do their thesis on Euler.
But, you know, he was the son of a pastor, you know, amongst other things, and he was by far one of the geniuses in the history of math. By far. I mean, he was off the charts. I mean, I actually studied him also. You know, he did all this stuff with optics and mechanics and astronomy. And no, I remember he did calculus. I remember geometry, trig, algebra, number theory. We could have that conversation. Just so you know, Euler, this I remember, is the only mathematician. Imagine having a star named after you. He had two numbers named after him. There's a calculus number known as E, right, which you know. Of course, all your listeners are fascinated by that. That's like 2.7.
Well, think about it. It's the backbone of the Black-Scholes model, just for a starter. It's the backbone of the binomial options model. It's the backbone of discounting formulas. You have that E constant, 2.7. And the reason why it's so amazing and so profound is it is the exponential base.
I hope your listeners appreciate you, but there was the Euler constant from the Euler number for calculus.
You're right.
And that was a number that was like 0.57 something. So this is I went to a place called the Bronx High School of Science.
They did a big math survey to all the mathematicians of the country. They said, what is the most eloquent, beautiful, non-esoteric formula in all of mathematics? And universally agreed that it was Euler's formula. But he takes E, and you remember, and then he takes it like pi minus, I want to say, the square root of -1. So there you have that, not irrational, but imaginary number. He included every single major area from exponents, multiplication, division, 1, and 0. Why don't you tell us a bit more about any contact information you might have for the listeners and any other projects you're working on?
Well, the main thing, projects, personally, you know, the music, davidgerwitz.com, they should go to. I play a lot of benefit concerts for nonprofit organizations like Special Olympics and a homeless group up in Toronto and all sorts of places. That's my joy. And then as far as the research, which on gold and silver and everything, they should write to charlesnenner.com, Google Charles Nenner, and write in, say they heard us speaking, and they'll get a free month of the research. And someone will be in touch with them afterwards about the different subscription options.
Very good. Well, listen, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and we hope to have you on future episodes of GoldSeek.com Radio.
Likewise, and my best to you, and I really enjoyed it.
It's time for the question and answer segment on GoldSeek.com Radio and opening up the digital mailbag. First, it's William, who expresses his gratitude for the many interviews over the years here. We're starting our 9th year. He has some feedback regarding a recent show. He thinks that one of the reasons that people lose their courage or get discouraged in holding precious metals is due to a lack of consistency among precious metals experts. Well, hello, William. You know, 2013 was a particularly difficult year. I guess that goes without saying for our favorite investment. But just like everything in life, you know, perspective, I think, is key. After a 12-year winning streak, you know, enthusiasm for the precious metals was near a peak there in the beginning of 2011. Now, that's not to say that the typical investor owns metals now, but the barbarous relic certainly caught the attention of millions of investors as it approached that 2,000 point in silver near $50. The last time that silver ran that high, the powers that be colluded and changed the rules mid-game, crushed the price. What I find interesting is the lack of dialogue, though, regarding how silver and gold have held up so well. Silver only retraced the parabolic move from 2010 to 2011. Could say it's still a few dollars above that low point. Gold has overshot the point a bit, but then it had had the least reactions along the way. From a technical vantage point, I think the damage has been intense, no question, but not so extreme that a recovery is impossible. So tying this diatribe back in with the original question, the point is that market dynamics can change. This is precisely what occurred last year, forcing pundits to reassess their initial evaluations. Forecasts and predictions are rarely carved in stone, any more than the weather forecast. Another key component to the commodities sell-off has been the equities market rally. Now, after a 12-year bear market, stocks are back in favor. However, signs of frothiness are certainly starting to show up all over the place. I suspect that much of the equities rally has been orchestrated by the Fed's hired guns at the major investment banks to ease the transition of the new Fed governor. Remember, Alan Greenspan became the Fed head in 87 at the market peak. Similarly, Ben Bernanke took over at the helm in 2006, not too far before the 2007 peak and credit crisis smackdown. And if history holds, we should expect a market top probably sometime in 2014. Now, bear in mind that 1.5 million Americans lost their unemployment benefits last weekend, and another 4 million are scheduled to do so this year. Plus, the official unemployment figures are so muddled that it's hard to believe the recovery story. Just look at the employment participation rate. Since the credit crisis of 08, the rate of employed plunged and remains at the lowest level in decades. Eventually, these realities will catch up with equities, because unemployed folks, well, their wallets are thin and they stay closed. This will hurt corporate profits. Funds will shift back into those unloved sectors, making gold and silver the investments du jour. Next at bat, Dennis is also concerned about the recent interviews. Hi, Dennis. You know, I think I covered this in the last message, but, you know, changes in trend are always painful for us. That's where the fleet-footed cyclical investors eat our lunch. Still, the serial correlation concept is sound. We buy out of favor assets, undervalued, well below their intrinsic value, and hold until either the metrics get out of whack or the price fails to cooperate. The amount of pessimism in the precious metal sector I actually view as a positive. Sir John Templeton was fond of saying, buy when folks are absolutely sick of the investment. We seem to be reaching a selling climax. If this next bounce fails, I would expect one final push to 1,000 gold and maybe 15 or so silver. That would probably be the ideal entry point, but why wait? You know, if you're not buying on margin, you can accumulate physical. And does a point or two, a dollar or two on silver really matter when you're looking for $50 to $100 silver? Incidentally, did you see the new documentary based on Sir John Templeton's life and career? The name is Contrarian, and I posted a link for my Alpha Stock subscribers. It's available on most satellite providers and should be available on Netflix and Amazon.com soon. He started like many of us, just a childhood entrepreneur, lemonade stands, and like Warren Buffett, you know, probably with the paper routes. Interestingly, I learned much from studying his technique many years ago. He borrowed $10,000 during the Great Depression, bought loads of penny stocks, which subsequently, well, went out of business, but a handful. And those that did recover quadrupled his initial investment. Similarly, each day I search through 15,000 stocks and settle for less than 0.1%, and then further hone the number down to maybe 1 or 2, maybe 3. In general, I like stocks that were high flyers a few years earlier. Maybe they lost a lawsuit or had a bad CEO, but price has put in a solid floor. Valuations are off the charts. Not every stock is a grand slam. Now, that's what protective sell stops are for, but more than not, we see sharp moves due usually to technical, fundamental, and valuation factors. Key point is that we need to put the probabilities in our favor using individual factors such as stock alpha, earnings, revenue, discounted cash flow, book value, trailing price to earnings, earnings before interest and tax, and several other formulas we've picked up over the years from folks like Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett. On a side note, there was an interesting article from Zero Hedge this week that I put up for my Alpha newsletter subscribers noting how John Maynard Keynes and Nikolai Copernicus apparently had similar outlooks on money. Listeners may recall that Copernicus is well known as one of the originators of modern astronomy and cosmology. He dared to battle the status quo, like the Italian scientist Galileo Galilei, proving that the planets orbited around the sun and not vice versa, not around the Earth. Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler took the analysis to the next stage, proving that the orbits were elliptical. Nevertheless, what few people realize is that Copernicus was also one of the first economists, who even wrote a book and an article on the subject, titled Treatise on the Mining of Coin, where he states that the debasement of currency is one of the hallmarks of economic destruction. Some folks have speculated that it was Keynes who picked up on this. He was an avid reader of classical scientists and may have gleaned this bit of wisdom from Copernicus. Both men realized that devaluing a currency destroys every nation wherever it occurs. A little bit off topic there, I digress, but thanks for your great question there, Dennis. Next, it's on to James, who writes about my Gibson's Paradox article and the inaccuracy of the forecast. He points out there was no Fed back in Gibson's time to rig the markets. Hi, James. You know, I think you're very close to the mark, but I'd suggest that you brush up a bit on Gibson's Paradox or reread the article. You see, it all boils down to interest rates, negative interest rates. The forecasts really are all based on those rates. So since the price of gold is determined by a negative interest rate, since rates have been moving higher since the article was published, that actually proves Gibson was right. So it's not Gibson's Paradox at fault, only the linear prediction based on the assumption that rates would remain low. Now, of course, we know that there are many factors that cause bull markets in the metals, not just low rates. For example, supply and demand is out of kilter, and then demand is skyrocketing, but supply is dwindling worldwide. There are more than twice as many people on the earth since the last gold bull market, billions of whom have access to wealth and precious metals, which simply just didn't exist 30, 40 years ago. Then there is the important factor of industrial usage, which continues to sap supplies, such as our solar panels, TV sets, computers, cell phones, calculators, Wi-Fi devices, iPads, iPhones, printers, fax machines, and a bevy of electronic components consume vast quantities of precious metals, but individually and in tiny amounts, making the reclaiming of said metals economically unfeasible for most folks. Then we need to examine the slow-motion central bank run on gold, as even ancillary central banks scramble to repatriate gold from Fort Knox, the New York Fed, and London, among other places, where much, if not all, of the gold reserves have reportedly have already been leased out or swapped so many times that few, if anyone, can say who really owns what. This scenario compares to the CDO and MBS fiasco, where so many parties were involved that ownership of the underlying asset, i.e. mortgages, was virtually unknown but to a small handful of PhDs. But we haven't yet even really begun to scratch the surface. Let's talk about the national debt ceiling and budget, which keeps getting kicked down the road, and the Fed's $3 trillion balance sheet with another $1 trillion slated for 2014, then the $17 trillion national debt, plus another $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities. Then there is that pesky problem of interest rate-sensitive derivatives. You'll remember what Warren Buffett referred to as the weapons of financial mass destruction. Currently, our top four or five investment banks have over $250 trillion of these WMDs on their balance sheets. Regular listeners will forgive me once per year on the show for mentioning this, but if you haven't read Frank Partnoy's Fiasco, it's a quick and fantastic book that outlines the pitfalls of toxic debt, and he did so about 10 years before it was even in the mainline news. They find gullible public and private folks who want to ratchet up their returns. They're tired of average returns, usually for altruistic purposes, such as funding for public projects and schools and things of that nature. But the high rate is the lure, which quickly snags the investor with a three-pronged hook. Hidden in illegible text is the downfall of most investors, the inevitable toxic debt trap. But just when the case for precious metals couldn't be any more compelling, let's talk about Cyprus, MF Global, the Polish pension fund quagmire, plus the issue of hypothecation, which is just fancy lingo for bail-ins, putting the customer and taxpayer on the line for corporate and government excesses and lack of transparency. Even with all of the aforementioned topics, there's still the issue of the largest and most comprehensive confiscation of all, inflation. It's insidious, it's the cruelest of taxes, which punishes those in greatest need, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, not to mention savers and retirees. Can 50% of Americans truly live off of the efforts of the remaining half? Currently, the government is the largest employer, and half of America receives some sort of financial compensation. Of course, we have not even addressed peak oil and the potential for geoeconomic ramifications of King Hubbard's peak and the end of dollar hegemony, i.e. the petrodollar arrangement. As Michael Rupert is fond of saying, each 1 calorie of groceries we consume requires at least 10 calories of petroleum. For instance, 3 calories of fertilizer, pesticides, fungicides, parasites, perhaps another 3 calories of planting, harvesting, and processing, another 3 calories for transporting to the grocery shelves, and a remaining calorie to bring it all home to the cupboard or a restaurant. So what will happen when suddenly the oil supply continues to slide down the right side of Hubbard's Peak? Well, it'll simply still require about 10 calories, but the petroleum will be twice as expensive, or even more because of supply and demand concerns. Now, this will also make precious metals mining more costly. The expense will be passed on to the market, and some operations will close their doors until prices increase, which they will. You might be scratching your head saying, Chris, they'll just find another Anwar. They'll just find another North Sea, a massive oil reserve. According to the world's top analysts, we're tapped out. All of the big finds have come and passed. Our technology is just that clever. Many of the top wells around the world, with maybe the exception of Saudi Arabia, are just being pumped full of seawater. All that's left is just what's being pumped out. We're, of course, using up our light sweet crude, which requires the least refining and thus makes it much more valuable. So at the end of the day, the Prius owners may inherit the earth. Hybrid cars could be the next big thing. Then the final topic I'd like to raise is the small modicum of investment funds in precious metals. Some estimates show less than 1% of pension funds are invested in the metals. The pool of available funds is enormous. In Japan alone, sources show over $3 trillion in pension funds just waiting for a safe home. Scared money amid the bond market instability and stock market volatility. If even a tiny fraction of the pension funds in Japan, North America, and the European Union begin to flow into the metals, it is impossible to calculate just how high gold could fly, but many estimates range from 10,000 and up. Lastly, one personal concern that is only now beginning to catch hold in the blogosphere and not yet in the mainstream media comes from the Japanese prefecture of Fukushima. Now, I know that this is a controversial topic, but before I went into economics, my passion was for physics and cosmology, and that's not cosmetology, thank you. I own 2 Geiger counters, and I can attest to the increase in background radiation, particularly accumulated alpha, beta, and even gamma radiation in many of our foods. Now, I suspect this could be at least viewed in retrospect as a nearly extinction-level event for the Northern Hemisphere. And that's, of course, the worst-case scenario. The way in which the media seems to be downplaying this event speaks volumes. It does look like the cover-up of the century. Now, my Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers have been prepared with all the information, devices, and web pages that they need to monitor, stay out of the rain when we have RADCOM 5 alerts, for instance, and even RADCOM 4 alerts. Baking soda in the shower. If you have been caught in the rain or your child, keep in mind that infants and unborns are 100 to 1,000 times more susceptible to radiation poisoning. Frightening. As a, you know, the father of a 5-month-old or so, it's a truly frightening prospect. As the gravity of the situation becomes more widely known, panic will likely set in. Economies will implode, and the only money left standing, in my opinion, will be in the precious metals, canned foods, Geiger counters, underground shelters, self-contained tilapia greenhouses, etc. So bringing it all together, James, I think the key point is that there are many factors other than negative interest rates and Gibson's paradox at play here. Okay, down from the podium, ending my sermon with a humble amen. And on that note, we're going to wrap up the Q&A segment today. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We want you to stay with us.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I had to laugh to prevent myself from getting sick to my stomach when I read a Reuters headline this week that said, "Housing and jobs data weaken, but overall economic picture still upbeat." Come again? How can the overall economic picture still be upbeat when housing and jobs data are weaker? Significantly weaker? U.S. home sales hit close to their 1-year lows in November, and new filings for unemployment benefits And here's that word again, unexpectedly rose, putting what was called a wrinkle into a supposedly bright economic future. According to the National Association of Realtors, sales of previously owned homes fell 4.3% in November, which is the lowest in a year and the third straight monthly drop. The average interest rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage rose to 4.42%, which is up a full percentage point since April of this year. Initial claims for unemployment increased by 10,000 to 379,000, which is the highest since March. Despite this negative news, we're supposed to believe that all is well, especially with the stock market. Following the Fed's statement that quantitative easing will begin tapering from $85 billion to $75 billion a month in January, the stock market shot up 292 points. Or did it? Well, not initially. For 3 minutes following the Fed statement, from 2 p.m. to 2:03 p.m., the stock market began nosediving, just as it has during all previous suggestions the Fed could, should, or would taper. But at 2:03 p.m., some invisible force intervened into the market, and it was up, up and away, so that over the next 2 hours, the market rose 292 points right on cue. And at the same time, right on cue, gold dropped nearly 3%. Markets are not believable anymore. In fact, they are quite unbelievable. Where's all this good news we hear about 24/7 on mainstream media? It's not readily apparent when one pulls their nose away from CNN or the nightly news. Everything that should be up, like gold, is down. And everything that should be down, like the Dow, is up. The stock market is a Ponzi scheme that reminds me of January and February of 2000, just before the dot-com crash. How quickly everyone forgets. Chris, on February 21st and 2nd, I'll be speaking at the second annual Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas with 15 speakers, 3 panel discussions on one amazing day. Details are on my website, and until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.